December 21st, 2012, the winter solstice. On that day, the great odometer of ancient Maya time, known as the long count, will revert to zero. What does that mean for us? What might it have meant for the Maya? And I think even more interestingly, and I had this topic in the context of the theme of time, telling time in the Khan Institute this year, what is it about our current fascination with ends of time? What do ends of time mean to us in general? Well, those are the questions I want to entertain here this afternoon. And to get the answers, you can Google up any of the 281,000 entries you'll find on Maya Creation 2012. At least as of yesterday afternoon was 281,000. It was only 207,000 last December. I don't check this very regularly. But you will find, if you go and Google up this topic, that all of the predictions divide sharply into two halves. There are those who predict that it will be a great blow-up on the one hand, and on the other hand, those who predict it will be a great bliss-out. Blow-up, bliss-out. Now, I know you're all very busy people, so I want to refer you to Jeff Stray, whose website is called Dire Gnosis. He claims to be the great encyclopedist of 2012 and advertises his website, bottom, as the place that packs the most significant parts of the 2012 message into bite-sized packages for busy people on their lunch hours. So if you're in your lunch hour having a quick iced coffee and you want to be updated on this, Jeff Stray says you should see Dire Gnosis. On the meter of blow up and bliss out, I think probably the most extreme apocalyptic predictor of all is Lawrence Joseph, whose book is entitled Apocalypse 2012. He claims his publisher made him do that. He tells us that 2012 will be more tumultuous, catastrophic, and revelatory than any other year in human history. It will make you think twice about your retirement plans. It's older people in the audience will want to think twice about that. Daniel Pinchbeck, the self-styled prophet, formerly a journalist, his metaphysical opus, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, tells us that he will reveal secret thoughts about suppressed dimensions of being that are embedded in Maya 2012 philosophy that can save the world from impending environmental disaster. You need to ingest large quantities of LSD in order to acquire that take. I know because I was on Montel Williams with him and he did all the talking and was really pushing the lysergic acid, which was big in my early days of teaching, not on my part, but on my students' parts, many of whom are your parents and grandparents. There are many texts on this topic, very engaging texts that speak of cosmic convergences, galactic alignments. Galactic is a word I certainly want to explore with you today because it's very paramount in so many of these explanations. Jose Arguelles in The Maya Factor tells us that the moment, and we really focus on the moment of time here, what I call the Y12 moment in my book, I copped that from Y2K, he says that it will be the most opportune time to reconnect with the upgrading of the light-life radiogenetic process at the acupuncture points, that is to say, the all-planetary light-body grid points in the body of Mother Earth. I have taken the trouble to write the statement down because the last time I gave this talk, I didn't have it written down, and someone came up to me after the lecture and said, what's wrong with that? Scientific language. John Major Jenkins, a software engineer who turned prophet, probably the most popular of all the prophets, claims that we are slowly moving toward the center of the galaxy, and that when the planes align, the world will be transformed on December 21, 2012. We will connect with our cosmic heart at the womb of Maya creation, which he refers to as the Great Rift in the Milky Way galaxy. And here you see a diagram from his book in which he shows you the slow progress of the sun at the solstice as it transcends the galactic center. I have to say at the solstice because the sun moves all the way around through the constellations of the zodiac every year. But the position at different times of the year, different dates of the year, slowly changes and drifts. And there it will lie at the center of the galaxy at the Y12 moment. It's all told, says Jenkins, in the ancient Maya inscriptions. For example, Stela 25 of Itzapa, which is actually not a Mayan site, peripheral Mayan site, where he contends the Maya long count was invented. And he tells us that the great cosmic tree, the great Kaiman, which transforms into a cosmic tree, stands erect as the galaxy stands erect at the moment of creation. The story is all played out in the Popol Vuh, the K'iche book of Maya creation, shown in a ceramic rollout vase on the top, where you see the pretender deity in the last creation, right at the beginning of the present creation, the pretender deity, this macaw bird, Vukub Kakish, pretending to be the sun, is done away with by a blowgunner, one of the hero twins, who shoots him out of the tree and saves creation for the real sun to come forth. And if you look at the galaxy, says Jenkins, you will see that it aligns this way at the moment of creation. There you see the scorpion at the base of the tree. You saw him in the last picture, although he's turned around. And the Big Dipper represents that bird, although he's not quite in the tree, sort of flying out of the tree. This is cosmic determinism. It's mapped in the galaxy. And the Maya knew about this, and they knew that the next turnover would happen in December 21, 2012. And if you read those inscriptions, he goes on to tell us that this great rift is indeed the womb of creation, and does it not look like a womb? And that is where we will encounter this moment of rejuvenation of all human cultures. Now, I'm going back and forth on the pendulum here in case you don't realize the game plan from blow up to bliss out. Back comes Larry Joseph, who's got some wonderful quotes about things that are going to happen, a whole panoply of things. What will happen when we move toward the center of the galaxy? Well, Joseph writes, there's a black hole at the center of the galaxy. It's sucking up energy, matter, and time. And when it gets blocked out for the first time in 26,000 years, the time it takes the sun at the solstice to go all the way around, on December 21, 2012, at 11:11 p.m. UT, the solar system will be thrown out of kilter. Supergiant flares will erupt on the sun's surface. Well, you can read the rest of the passage. We'll have a problem with the magnetic field. There'll be a planetary alignment. And the whole business will be deadlier than anything we've ever encountered since Homo sapiens have been around. That's Apocalypse 2012. Solar flares, he tells us, will peak in the year 2012 with the solar cycle. So beware, says Joseph, for this will be a disastrous solar cycle. Carl Johann Kalman, a German engineer, it's interesting how many of these people are engineers, a large number of them, engineering these explanations for us, wrote of the harmonic coincidence in the Mayan calendar. He has his own theory of evolution. He claims that there is evolutionary progress, but it's based on a mathematically converging series that begins with the first event at Big Bang creation, the second at the Cambrian explosion. That's a lot of time. But then the events converge. The Sarajevo incident, Hitler, and then most recently, I think, the decoding of the DNA. And this all converges mathematically on the moment of 2012. Links on Kalman's website tell us how to prepare for this moment. Cleanse your colon with bentonite clay elixir so that you will be fully receptive to the pranic energy or life force that will arrive then to reset your body in balance. Thus spake Kalman. It's all in the Old Testament Daniel and New Testament Revelation, if you read it. So say the Bible decoders, 70 weeks are decreed to clear up our act, or the end of the world shall come. If you interpret 70 weeks to be 70 years, which many decoders who don't care about the units they use seem to prefer, why then that will equal one day of precession. For if you take the 26,000 years of precession and divide it by 360 degrees, roughly the number of days in a year, you get one day's worth of motion of precession, 1 degree's worth, 1 day's worth, as about 70 years. And so the decoders say this is not a coincidence. The message with the number 70, the magic number 70, is concealed in these biblical statements. Well, you're probably wondering what an academic is doing babbling about this, if you're skeptical, and why he would seek to write a book. For after all, we all know that academics don't write accessible books. It's not cool. I have tenure, so fortunately I'm in a good position to do this. But I really think, as I was saying to Suzanne at the beginning of the hour, this really ought to be our teachable moment. I mean, we who teach these subjects should grab on to the opportunity to teach a little bit about what astronomy really is involved here and what the Maya really were doing. And that's partly why I wrote my book. But the other reason is that I got into an email correspondence with a young high schooler from Halifax who wrote me about 5 years ago and told me that his young friends were quite seriously concerned that the world was going to come to an end, and they weren't putting me on. And they asked my opinion about these predictions because they seemed so scientific with their language and their equations. And they were genuinely worried about this. So we carried out this long-term emailing in which the group up there in Nova Scotia introduced me to a lot of websites I didn't know about. And I dedicated my book, in fact, to Dylan O'Coin from Halifax because he's the one who prompted me to start writing this. Well, he was 16 at the time. He's now 21. But he still hasn't outgrown the fascination with the Maya, and I think he's taking the Maya very seriously now. There are several things wrong with this scenario. And so I want to take up the second part of my talk, which deals with the question, well, what did all of this mean to the Maya, as far as we know? What evidence is there that this may have meant anything to the Maya? So let's explore that a little bit. And I want to begin by telling you that time and number for the Maya was truly an obsession. These Maya, who ruled the Central American region between roughly the birth of Christ and the Crusades, we can call it the Dark Ages in Europe, where we use the metaphor of light to describe history in our own way. So dark means not a whole lot was going on. But then, of course, I insult people who study or Byzantine studies. A lot was going on. But nonetheless, these events were taking place in the New World with the Maya. They were incredible astronomers, numerologists, calendrical keepers. And the message that comes from the Maya comes in two basic forms, carved in stone, as you see on the left, Stela B at the ruins of Copan, very, very high relief carving, and in the handful of codices or bark paper painted documents, of which only three survived, the rest having been burned by the Spaniards, which the chronicler Diego de Landa tells us, we burned them all because they contained lies of the devil, which they regretted deeply. And that section of the Dresden Codex is a piece of one of the documents that has survived. If you look at the carvings in stone, you begin to acquire the idea that the message that comes across here has a lot to do with the ruler and the ruler's connection to the divine. Here we see portrayed on the front side, the left, the great king of Copan. A lot of people call him the great Ramses II of Copan because all the monuments are his, practically. Washakla Hunubakawil. He's shown holding a ceremonial staff with a double-headed serpent, double-headed kaimon, banded probably with planetary signs. He has holstered on his belt a pair of stingray spines with which to draw blood from his genitals, which he will offer to the gods, which he will burn and offer to the gods, thereby demonstrating his bond with the gods through blood. As Michael Coe, the anthropologist, has said, the Maya culture is bonded by blood. Blood is the mortar that held that culture together. But it's on the side where we encounter the calendrical date, and there the long count. So I should explain a little bit what that is, because it's what's at issue in 2012, because it's going to turn over. There are always these elaborate dates. Now, the Maya always had their unit of days, the basic currency. They did not keep hours, but they did keep days. And the word for day in Maya is keen. They multiplied the day by 20 to get months. Which makes sense, for they counted on the fingers and toes. They had a vigesimal system. The dots stood for ones, I think, no doubt, because counting was and still is gestural. And so the points of the fingers become the dots, and the bar is nothing more than the hand of five dots extended. So a bar is five and a dot is one. They also had years called tunes, which they arrived at by multiplying the months, not by 20, but by 18. They did that because 18 times 20 takes you closer to a year, so it's a more sensible interval than 400. Now, that system was in play for a long time, probably since 600 BC. It was around 200 BC that I think some very, very smart individual who really wanted to grab hold of deep time, this is a subject I know you're dealing with at the Institute because I've read some of your précis, wanted to grab a hold of deep time, as do most hierarchically organized cultures, and so extended that scale by multiplying the years into scores of years called katuns, and then scores of years called baktuns. And so this inscription reads, it was nine baktuns, nine scores of years since creation, 15 scores of years, 0 years, 0 months, 0 days, a triple O, that it was since then that this ruler was invested with such and such a power. In fact, it was when he let blood in a ceremony. It's interesting that this is a little bit like a score of years turnover with three zeros in it. Of course, the one we're in for is a major turnover of all the digits, so watch out what's going to happen. So there is that long count, and we see it inscribed everywhere. But it makes very clear in this statement that the purpose of erecting this stone is that it's a kind of time marker that reads, if you go further down, and I can't take time to go into it, that this was his khatun, this king of Copan. It's his khatun. He owns this khatun. And he lets his blood at this 20-year period to bond with his ancestors who are in heaven. In fact, if you look up in his turban, you can see his ancestors mounted like a couple of mahouts on elephants. Actually, the elephants are stylized macaw beaks, although there was a big controversy about that some 100 years ago. They thought there were Hannibal came over with his elephants here. But there you can see the ancestors up on Macaw Mountain, Makawitz. There's the macaw's eye. He is having a vision of his ancestors, probably because he's ingested some hallucinogenic substance before he let his blood. So this is really high drama, but it really is about connecting the ruler to the gods in heaven. So fascinated were the Maya with number that they even saw fit to deify each numerical god. And so here we see an inscription done in full figure glyphs as numbers. Here the god who is number nine bears a load of time, the baktuns on his back. He carries a tump line. And if you go to Mexico or Peru, you'll see the peasants walking with the tump lines carrying their loads of firewood back to the hut. There he carries that burden of time. And he literally is dropping that burden of time on us to show us that this is what's happening here. Below him, the god 15 and the god 5 carry their bundles. They're recognizable by their funny turbaned hats with little circles on them. And notice the resemblance between the facial expressions or the faces of 15 and 5. The 15 is the same as 5, except his jaw is bone. Well, our teens and our ordinals resemble each other too. And then the gods 00 below, we have 9-15-500, Stela D. Copan. That's a half of a katun, a hotun measurement. So these are mile posts, like marker posts on the highway that give you kilometers, except they're temporal marker posts. Now, as I said, there are clearly some things wrong with the scenario I think is being painted about what's going to happen in 2012. And my criticisms divide into two parts. There are the astronomical ones, and there are the cultural ones. To begin with the cultural ones, I do not believe that the galaxy is lined up as shown on Stela 25. In fact, my colleague Julia Guernsey-Kappelman has done an entire book on pre-classic Stele, and she shows here that what you have in Stela 25 is one of many avian representations of rulers. Rulers with wings. I liken this to the dream we all have at one or another time about being Superman or Superwoman. You imagine that you can fly, and I think here you can almost see the ruler looking up in envy at the macaw bird. He even has grown a wing there, thinking about the power of flight. And this is what you see in these other late pre-classic and other pre-classic images. They are avian costumed rulers, and they really had this kind of bird worship notion. I want to mention, too, that the galaxy lines up the way you see it, not once in 26,000 years, but once a day, because it rotates in 24 hours, 23 hours and 56 minutes. And if you want to pick a time of the day, like midnight, it does that once a year. So there's nothing particularly unique about the way the galaxy lines up. Nor do the Maya conceive of the galaxy as a tree. The Milky Way, in fact, is not a tree. It is a road. It's the road of the dead, the road along which the dead go to the afterworld. The notion that it's a tree is strictly contemporary. There is no cultural continuity between that notion that it's a tree and that the Maya thought it was a tree 1,000 years ago. At least that has not, that is far from having been proven. My biggest gripe about using computers, and I was sharing this with Susan before, beware, students, of using the computer maps of the sky. The sky doesn't look the way you think it does on a computer. I dare you to go out and look at the Milky Way and see it the way it's seen on one of these desktop devices. Oh, you can use them to make useful calculations, but never let that substitute for seeing the stars as they really are. You need to go out into a dark place, away from city lights, and see the sky for itself, because it's quite different. I'm amazed to hear the number of theories that come out of the mouths of prophets about what's in the sky who have never really bothered to look at the sky. So the content of the inscriptions largely has to do with dynastic sequences, the power of the dynasty, the connection of the dynasty to the ancestors who reside in heaven. What about the codices? Well, they're fewer in number, and they're far more esoteric. Here I show you a page from the Madrid Codex, so-called because it resides in the library in the city of Madrid, where you see procedures for ritual. And in this case, here are the gods receiving, well, it looks like Christmas and they're receiving presents. They are receiving, actually, crowns, matted crowns to put on their heads as debt payment from people who worship them. And these codices are prescriptions for ritual debt payment. What are you paying for? Well, you're paying for the good crop that came last year, or you're giving double payment because you've got a bad crop. You had a bad crop and you hope that the next one will be good. Everything we know about these codices points to them being ritual procedures, practical ways of worshiping the gods, even down to giving the number of the day, day of the week, the day of the month when you do this, and then jumping an intervallic number to the next day. And that seems to be what the codices contain. There are, however, references to creation. The last page of the Dresden Codex, for example, shows a sky kaimon vomiting water. He's banded with the same kind of planetary bands we saw on the staff held by the ruler. And there is an old woman pouring water from a vase, an old woman deity, water issuing from eclipse glyphs, and here a person or a god with a lance. And it's interesting, we found a passage in the Book of Chilam Balam, colonial period, Khatun prophecies, that could be a caption for this picture. This is a pre-Columbian document done before the Spaniards came. And after the Spaniards came, one finds written in Spanish these documents, which read in part, "And then came the great Kaimon deity, that this deluge may be complete. The word of the Khatun prophecy," the overturning of the Khatun, "one fetching of rain," you see the woman pouring the rain, "one lance of rain," you see the deity putting that rain down. But is this a literal transcendent message? Is this a message being sent to us about the end of the world from the Maya? Or is it what those who study these manuscripts and documents think it might more rather be, namely a kind of metaphoric framework for reckoning and renewal? I think only of Mardi Gras and New Year's when we celebrate by purifying ourselves after indulging in wretched excess. Well, we don't have a codex for how to do that, certainly not for indulging in the wretched excess, but certainly the next day, those of us who are religious will go and have our ritual procedure done. And I think these ends of time cycles, whether they be short or long, really have a lot in common The one we're in for, of course, is a longer time cycle, but I don't see it any differently. There are at long count inscriptions written in stone, and this one might give us a little clue as to what the Maya thought about the last creation. And there you see the number of the long count, 13, two bars and three dots, 0, 0, 0, 0, 13 and four zeros. And if you read the text, I won't read the whole thing, but it does tell us that three stones were set. They planted the stones, these people, these deities. It happened at Lying Down Sky, which is the name of Quirigua. Anybody who lives in Quirigua would, of course, say this was where the world was created. That's what they say in Palenque. It's what they say in Chichen Itza. The world was created for us right here. And the three stone is an interesting reference because that's the three stone hearth, which you see in all the Maya huts, always three stones that you put the kettle on. And the three stone hearth of creation was the original heart that was created. So in other words, this is where the fire of creation came from on this day, and it happened here. It's interesting that the lower part of the constellation of our Orion is the three-stone hearth. Kappa, Zeta, and Beta Orionis make a triangle. And the fire in the hearth, of course, is the Orion Nebula. It's a beautiful concept in the Maya world. Here in Cobas Tila 1, I think a scribe got carried away. He may have had extra space on the top. This stone reminds me of when we were kids and we'd have contests to see who could say the biggest number. And one would say a gazillion or a kajillion or a zillion zillion. I always came up with 111, which I thought was a fairly big number. But what happened here is that ahead of the 13,000, someone put in a huge number of 13s that take us all the way back to a period of time long before Big Bang creation. These are numerologists having their wildest fantasies, creating big numbers, trying to probe here in a very speculative way what deep time was all about. There are also big numbers in the codices. Here we are in the so-called serpent number pages of the Dresden Codex, where you have long, long, long count numbers wrapped around a serpent. These are the so-called serpent numbers, aptly named. They run into hundreds of millions of years. Now, some prophets have tried to work out precession by cherry-picking data and dividing and multiplying and performing various manipulations. I've not been convinced that any of these explanations suggest that the Maya were actually calculating this 26,000-year period. And having said that, I now want to turn to the astronomical side of the ledger and talk a little bit about what precession is, because it's one of the most misunderstood concepts. I won't go into the physics, as is shown in this diagram. Precession of the equinox is a fascinating period of time. It's one of the great long cycles in astronomy. 26,000 years, and we probably know it as the time it takes for the pole star to become the pole star again. It happens because the Earth rotates in a different plane from which it revolves around the sun. Here you have the Earth rotating in this plane, and it goes around the sun in this plane, so the sun is way over there. The famous angle of tilt, 23.5 degrees, gives us the seasons. For example, if the sun is on the left, why we're getting a nice dose of sunlight in the northern hemisphere, so that's summertime, whereas it's winter down here. But it's because the Earth bulges due to its rapid rotation that we end up with precession. For the sun, with a little help from the moon, try to take that bulge and right it. They try to take that bulge and put it into the plane of the ecliptic. The Earth responds not by just doing this and turning into the plane ecliptic, but rather by having its axis gyrate, and the gyrate is the appropriate term because that's what a gyroscope does. It gyrates or makes a cone on the sky in a period of 26,000 years. And that means, and my students never like to hear this, that the coordinates of the stars change. It's as if there's no ground you can stand on. Imagine we go out of this lecture and our latitude and longitude has changed and we're somewhere where Boston used to be. I mean, it would be very unsettling to think that we're standing on ground that's shifting its reference point. So here's a little diagram showing you that the pole star, the pole migrates, the Earth's axis of rotation on the sky, if you extend it to the sky, migrates among the stars, happens to be situated at the tail end of Ursa Minor, where Polaris is today. That's why that's our pole star. But if you were around the time of ancient Egypt, why, Thuban, the faint star in the tail of the dragon, Draco, would have lain at the pole. And if the pole moves, so too does the equator, and so too does its intersection with the ecliptic. So I'm showing you the coordinates of the stars change. We measure our coordinates from the vernal equinox, which is one of the intersecting points of the equator and the ecliptic. These two planes cross. And that point migrates. It moves among the stars. And here you see it, and I'll show you on a bigger scale here, how the sun at the vernal equinox drifts among the constellations. It also drifts at the equinox. It drifts on your birthday. I mean, whatever, every day of the year, it drifts. By this amount, it takes 26,000 years to go all the way around the zodiac on your birthday. And here it is on the equinox. Why do I choose the equinox? Because most world calendars, at least in the Middle East, whence we derive our calendar, were based on the equinox. The Hebrew calendar was, so was the Roman. It's only a latter-day invention that we change the calendar to correspond to something else. Well, to correspond to the winter solstice, actually. So here we are in Pisces. Pisces is where we're located. We've been there ever since about the birth of Christ, which is why there's a lot of fish iconography associated with Christ, Christian symbolism. Before that, in the time of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, the vernal equinox sun was in Aries. And before that, in the time of the great early dynasties of the Old Kingdom of Egypt, it was in Taurus. And that's why you always see the disk of the sun between the horns of the Minoan bull, or even in some Egyptian iconography. Sekhet is often represented with a horn hairdress with a golden disk in the center. So recorded history can be measured in units of the precession of the equinoxes, whereby the sun moves from constellation to constellation. How long does it take? Well, it's 26,000 years to go through 12 zodiac signs. Do the math, and you come up with a little over 2,000 years, 21 and change, a little over 2,000 years to move from one sign of the zodiac to the next. The next one, of course, is Aquarius. You don't have to be old enough to have been around in the 60s to have heard about the musical Hair, which is now undergoing revival, and the great song, of which I could do a fabulous imitation, but I have to charge you extra for that and change my costume. That, of course, was It Is the Coming of the Age of Aquarius, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And my old hippie pals back in the 60s, I guess I was one of them too, were very dismayed to learn that it's not until 2712 AD that the sun enters Aquarius. But why not 1969? It seemed like a good period. So there's the sun migrating 2,000 years per constellation. Now that fits very well with the writings of St. Augustine, who tells us that the time to the second coming is parsed out in millennial bites, in thousand-year bites. And it's really interesting, our penchant for thinking millennially in terms of thousand-year periods. Augustine writes that there will be six such periods. And that works very well, particularly if you think the world began in 4000 BC, which a majority of Americans do think, that it did begin in 4000, maybe 38, 40%, that it did begin in 4000, give or take, BC, that you would have two jumps through the zodiac, two constellations, make a board game out of this if you want, two constellations of movement until Christ comes, and then only one more until you get the second coming, so say many prophets. That was to have happened some 8 years ago, and even if you're a mere freshman, sorry about mere, you will remember Y2K when all the computers were going to go crazy and so on. Well, here we are in 2009, heading for 2012, which for many prophets of the apocalypse is the correction that you have to make, because it really is going to be 2012 that all of this is going to happen. So it's very interesting. And in my research on where all of this came from, I tried to backtrack to how we got to romancing the Maya, and where this idea of world ages made its comeback. People have always, in different cultures, always believed in world ages, that there are these great transformations, these world ages that come about. In the case that I'm speaking of, the ages are star fixed. That is to say, the ages take place, great changes in world culture happen. They happen on these occasions when the sun moves on the equinox from one constellation to the next. And I think it starts with this book, famous book, called Hamlet's Mill. The year was 1969, and the authors advocated that there really is one big world myth, one monomyth, and it's transcultural. And the great changes that take place happen in these 2,000-year periods, a very big challenge. And I remember at the time, yes, I was teaching even then, my students would come to me and they'd, if you're older teachers now, you know they're always, about every 4 or 5 years, students come to you with a book they want to read. And sometimes you take this arrogant, smug academic, you don't want to read that, that's garbage. You learn more by reading what people bring to you, I think. You start from the point of ignorance and you learn from that. But I do remember reading this book. It took us on all sorts of pathways. But I have to say that the statement on the jacket was really telling, this written in 1969, that it is likely this book to remain a lion in everybody's path for years. And it certainly has been a lion in everybody's path, because this subject of star-fixed ages, the star-fixed ages of humanity, remains with us.